Hi, my name is Melanie B. Hyland from Norman, Oklahoma, and I belong to the Tornado Alley chapter of Sisters or Siblings in Crime, a national organization dedicated to education for mystery and crime writers of all genders. The Tornado Alley chapter sponsors this podcast to support and promote local and regional writers, whether they are well-established or emerging. Today, our guest is Oklahoma writer Vivian Zabel, an established novelist and a longtime writing teacher who has traveled the world and who draws on her travels for her characters. She styles herself as a people watcher who uses her observations and listening skills to make her historical fiction realistic. Today, Vivian will read from her recent novel, Burnt Offering, a finalist for the Oklahoma Book Award. Welcome, Vivian.
Thank you, Melanie. It's good to be here.
Well, I'm so glad that we could celebrate your writing and that we could have this interview today. I'm sure our listeners would like to hear about your research into ancient history and what inspired you to write Burnt Offering. Tell us a little bit about writing that novel.
Well, in my reading of the Bible, I probably read the scriptures 1,000 times about how during under King Ahaz's rule, they worshiped the idol Molech. Only Molech was, as an idol, was supposed to be given burnt offerings, and the people were burning their own children as sacrifices to this bronze idol. And all they were getting in return was this feeling of power that they might have, that they had actually were able to do such a horrible thing. And like I said, I'd read that scripture so many times, but a few years ago, I read it and it hit me hard. How could anyone literally give their own child as a burnt offering? How could they let that child die such a horrendous death because of some religious idea? And I thought, I couldn't do it. So how could those parents? I said, you know, there had to be people that were not allowing some children to be sacrificed. And then I started researching the time, and I started researching and reading the Bibles and putting all the scriptures together that were in different sections of the Bible dealing with that time period. And as a result, I had to write the novel. I had to let people know that even in that ancient time, people cared enough to fight evil. And, you know, there's some romance involved because even in the worst of time, people fall in love. And there was some mystery, like how they were going to catch a spy that had been sent by the government to find how those children were being taken away and hidden. There was some suspense on how Hedera, the main character, was going to escape a husband who wanted to kill her. They only had an adult son. And yes, they had even started taking their older children, even young adult children, and sacrificing them. Well, she had to find a way to save her son, even though he was a young adult. And how was she going to get away from her husband, who was one of the king's favorite noblemen, but his name was Tzarbar? How was she going to get away from him? Because he wanted to kill her and get a young wife so he could have children to sacrifice. So there was suspense involved. How was she going to escape? What was going to happen to her? What was going to happen to the son? And he had taken a young wife. How were they going to escape? So there was suspense and romance and mystery involved, but there was also this idea, this underlying idea that children were being sacrificed. They were being killed willfully murdered in a horrific way.
Wow. So that's pretty dramatic. And I like the way that you explain how the novel crosses a lot of different genres, because I think that happens in a lot of work. So it's a historical novel, it's a thriller, it's a lot of
Right.
different things, a mystery, and it's got that theme. Good and evil, that's pretty universal. I think people relate to that. Well, I've only been able to read the first chapters of Burnt Offering, as my book hadn't come in yet, but I found that your use of sensory detail was very compelling. You create an atmosphere where we see the clouds of dust. We smell and taste and feel the sensations of being in the desert. We feel the silk that they're touching, and they're just so many good images that put us there in the desert or the oasis. And you also create sympathy for your characters. Now, not the evil ones, but the characters in their dialogue, they have humor, they do care about their children, and they love each other. And we can really tell, I can tell that from just reading the first few chapters of the book. I care about these people. I don't want anything bad to happen to them. So that really raises the stakes when they face all these evil things. So if you would, for our listeners, please introduce a passage from the novel and read something so that other people can get a taste of what your work sounds like and what your style is.
All right, in Judah in the 18th century BC, King Ahaz sat and watched his own infant placed in the hands of a red-hot bronze idol. He heard the child's screams over the beating of 100 drums that they were supposed to try to drown out the child's screams. He watched the child turn red, then black as it burned alive. He smelled the odor of burnt skin. Yet he and his followers did what Moloch wanted, killing their own children. In the following scene from Burnt Offering, Hadera, the wife of one of the king's noblemen, Tazarbar, has escaped the husband who wanted to kill her. With the help of her wealthy Egyptian family, she's found safety in a farm several miles away from Jerusalem. This night, she visits with her companion maid Maza. Adara opened her mouth to respond, but a tap on the door interrupted her. Simeon opened it without waiting for anyone to invite him in. Adara, we have an emergency. He opened the door further to allow a man and a young woman carrying a child about 2 years old to enter. The man threw back his hood to reveal a scraggly beard and long unkempt hair. Do you not recognize me, mistress? Hadera leaped to her feet. Umzi, it's good to see you, but why are you here? She walked toward him and the woman. Who is this? As Simeon closed the door, Umzi replied, I'm with a band of rebels, and lately we've been helping women hide their children from being sacrifices. He touched the woman's arm. This is Adi, Barak's second wife, and her son. Barak's wife? I don't understand. Why did you bring her and her son here? Hedera backed away a couple of steps. Do you not know Barak is still searching for Tobias? And yes, you as replacements for her and the child? She shrugged one shoulder. Although he would never recognize you now. The woman raised her eyes from searching the floor. Please do not blame my child for what my husband does. Micah is innocent, and I want to keep him from being burned alive. Her eyes filled with tears, which she fought as she pleaded with Adara. Amzi tried to move us from a hiding place that was no longer safe to one that is. When the soldiers discovered us, they are close. Please help. I don't know what else to do, mistress, Amzi shrugged. Addie's son grew too large and vocal to stay where they were. I hoped you might hide us until the soldiers leave the area. He held a breath. I'm sorry because now we've put you in danger. Simeon spoke from behind Amzi. Hedera, they cannot leave without being found by the soldiers. Hedera nodded. I know, I know. She dropped to her chair. I cannot allow another babe to burn to death if I can save him. She looked at Adi, the child in her arms, Amzi, and then Simeon. Simeon, fix pallets in the hidden room off the kitchen. Help them settle in and give them food and drink. She paused before adding, "Your sons will be found. You must hide them." Hedera, they are safe. Simeon nodded. We had noticed soldiers in the area earlier today. Adi sobbed and hugged her son until he wiggled and fussed. Thank you, thank you. No, do not thank me. I pray Amzi and will be able to lead you to complete safety after the soldiers are gone. Hedera smiled, but her lips trembled. Now, please go with Simeon. There must be no sign of you nor any sound when the soldiers come. I'm sure they will be here before long. Mistress, please know I would not have brought Adi here if I could have found anywhere else. Amzi paused. We will leave as quickly as possible. Hedera turned to face her son's half-brother. Please visit with me before you leave the farm, but now go before you are found. Also, no one must call me mistress, as we all must be considered part of the family here. The man nodded and followed Simeon and the woman from the room. What have you done? Mazo demanded. Her frowning glare emphasized her anger. We are safe. But you have endangered yourself and us. Adira bit her upper lip before answering. I know, but I saved my son. Should she not be able to do the same? Your actions didn't put innocence at risk. Yes, they did. Belmont is now sought. My family would be in great danger if they weren't necessary to Pharaoh. She picked up the parchment from her mother. Rose dropped the missive in the fire. I hate we must always erase any trace of my family, of our old life. We must check that nothing is left. I'm sure the soldiers will turn the compound inside out as they try to find our guests. I will pray they will hurt no one while searching. And everyone thought me mad to insist on having secret places in this house. Never mind the tunnels from our cellar area to the outside farms, Cardera reported. Yet, here we are using them. Maza gasped. No, I could understand your fears, but don't, Maza. I know you and my family, who actually saw to the building and adaptations, believe me a bit mad. But no one can ever tell what might be needed. Cardera took a deep breath and exhaled. Perhaps I was given a premonition. Perhaps a new task was to be mine. This is how Hedera, the wife of one of the king's noblemen, became a part of the underground movement to save children from becoming a burnt offering to a bronze idol.
Wow, that just gives me chills. But we can place the same kind of fear and conflict and compassion, in modern circumstances. It made me think of the Holocaust and people trying to escape the Nazis, and anytime there's an evil regime. And
Well,
anyway.
even now, children are neglected and abused and are used. When you think of the children trafficking that is going on, the fact that they're being kidnapped and taken from different places and used in such horrible ways. What is so sad is that evil is still here. And people either ignore it or they take a stand. And sometimes we have to come out of our own comfort zones to protect the innocent.
Well, and writing is one of the ways that we can use our skills to do that. And you certainly are. And as a teacher, I know that you do care about children. You tell me you were a teacher for 30 years, which I can relate to. But I know that teaching actually doesn't leave a lot of time for writing. It's not that compatible. You're really busy with a lot of things. And you have some inspirational stories about becoming a writer. Tell us about getting started.
Well, my mother said that I told stories from the time I could start talking. And then I started writing as soon as I could print. In fact, I found in her things after she passed away, poetry that I had written when I was in the third grade. And during most of my younger years, I did have poetry and short stories and articles that had been published, but I never had time to actually sit down and write anything longer until the last year I taught. And I always taught writing in my English classes. I taught writing, and my students were expected to write. And the last year I realized, and I'd been reading how businesses were saying they couldn't get employees that even knew how to write a paragraph. And it was causing trouble because they couldn't write reports. They couldn't write narratives of what their groups were doing. So I said, all right, my English classes, one day a week, will write. I didn't care. They were going to write. They were going to write stories. They were going to write essays. They were going to write. And it would be their choice what they would work on during that hour. So I spread them out where it was a different class each day. So there I was teaching them to write. They were having to write. So I said, all right, I'm going to start writing my first book, because I was going to be an example of writing. And so every hour, 1 hour a day, I was writing with my classes. And I started my first novel. And it got sidetracked, but I did write that novel eventually, and it was one that also fits in with the fact that of this children situation, because two of my grandchildren had been stolen, and I didn't know where they were. I didn't know for over 12 years whether they were alive or not. Their father had taken them for his visitation time and never returned them. And it felt like a part of me had literally been ripped out. And I didn't know what to do with that grief. So I started writing a book where a young woman ends up having to rebuild her life several times, but then her ex-husband steals her children and what she goes went through. And it's not a happily ever after ending to the book, because when I finally finished it, I still didn't know if my grandchildren were alive or not. And one part of that book, I had the little girl visiting her grandmother, scribbling all over the new walls of a house, newly painted. And the grandmother's getting on her and she says, "But Gran," because my granddaughter couldn't say granny like the other kids did. "But Gran, say, love you, love you, love you." And in the book, I had the grandmother in there have that. And she couldn't scrub it off because it was a message from her missing grandchild. And that
Wow.
was on the wall for 13 years. And I researched what went on when children were taken. And one of the things I came across was that when children come back, they expect everything to have been frozen, just like it was when they left. And they end up feeling betrayed. Well, over 12 years later, every year, though, I put out online a letter to my grandchildren, how I missed them. And if I knew where they were, I would be in contact with them. And I put my email address. Over 12 years later, I get an email. "I think you're looking for me, and I think you're my grandmother."
Oh, that's wonderful.
And I emailed right back, "If you're really Ferris, you know what you call me." He emailed back, "Yes, Granny." And my grandchildren were back. "I'm going to write the sequel, Betrayed."
Well, I think that will be a wonderful book, and especially a follow-up on the tragedy, and as you say, all of the grief of losing those children. You have a happy story, though, about writing a book for one of your grandchildren.
Yes. I was working on Stolen, the one about my missing grandchildren. And we found out that one of my grandsons was a reluctant reader. He was having trouble. He, if he heard something, he would remember it. He was really good. But reading was a problem for him. Well, he loved sports. I mean, anything, but he loved baseball and football, if basketball, if it had a ball, he loved it. So I thought, okay, I'll find him some books about sports. Well, I went to bookstore after bookstore and I was looking at them. I thought, those were boring. I wouldn't want to read them. And so I said, and he already doesn't want to read. So I said, okay, I helped my husband. I played baseball. I played softball. I helped my husband coach Little League. So I said, and Kobe loves baseball. I'm going to write a book about baseball players. And there's going to be illustrations. As a teacher, I learned that reluctant readers are absolutely panicked when they just see page after page after page of nothing but words. And any kind of an illustration that breaks it up would help. So I went to baseball games with my grandsons. I took pictures and I got written permission from all the parents that if any of their kids ended up in a picture, that I had permission to use it. And I wrote the Base Stealers Club, which was a story about a baseball team. And somebody was stealing money out of their lockers during games. And so a part of the team decided they were going to find the thief. And they called themselves the Base Stealers Club because the only thing that should be stolen were bases. And I finished the book. It's probably lower teen, early, older middle grade age read a book. And I was at a elementary school where I'd been asked to do a presentation to their older elementary school students. And my grandson was at the middle school just up the road, and they got out of school before the elementary school did. And he came down to the elementary school, and the librarian asked him, said, "Have you read your mother's book, your grandmother's book?" He says, "No, only twice."
Oh, that just warms my heart. A reader, a converted reader. I want to say to our audience that to remind them that I am speaking today with novelist Vivian Zabel, who teaches and organizes writing classes for OWFI. Well, Vivian, you have been very involved with OWFI. Tell us about the workshops and writing opportunities that you have fostered through OWFI outside of the classroom.
Well, I've also pr been a presenter in, of workshops for other organizations. Like the I was invited to Anchorage, Alaska, one year, and I presented three workshops on writing. And I have for the some of the Texas conferences and whatever. But for OWFI, I've also had some of the sessions at some of the conferences. However, for years, there had been a group of us at OWFI that wanted to be able to have online writing workshops. We really wanted them for some of the high school age students because that would be an offering that isn't being met in a lot of areas. And a lot of schools, in fact, just few schools teach writing anymore. There is a lot of grading involved, and it is time consuming. And then with all the mandates that teachers have to cover, the writing gets pushed aside. So we were had been talking about it for years, and with the invention of Zoom and Google Meets, that gave us a platform. And so this is the first year we've tried it, and we wanted it to be timed so it might work for high school students to attend. And we know August is extremely busy. Forget anything extra at for school kids. So for September, October, November, we would have a workshop a month. December's busy. Then January, February, March, and April, we would have a workshop. And we scheduled them to be on the second Saturday afternoon of the month. And the idea was to record them so those that registered and couldn't actually attend could get a recording. We had technical difficulties. We think for the next year we will have it taken care of. But we have had this year volunteers who have taken a session for each of the months we have a workshop. We have two left, and we have right at 80 people who registered for those workshops, and not a one of them in high school. Not one. But we're hoping that people that are attending the workshops are then sharing.
Well, you may reach those kids yet. You're going to figure out how to do it, is what I suspect. But you're reaching all those 80 people who wanted to improve their writing and start writing. And people have asked me when I started the podcast, wouldn't I run out of people to interview? Oh no, I really that's not the problem. It's just getting doing one a month, it hardly scratches the surface. But it's so wonderful getting to know other writers. And we are so proud at Tornado Alley at our chapter of Sisters in Crime that you are a member of our group as well. And you've been a member. We haven't had a regional chapter for very long, for a couple of years, but you've been a member of Sisters in Crime for a long time. How did you get interested in Sisters in Crime?
Well, way back when, I can't even remember what it was called now, there was a online message kind of thing. And I met J.A. Jauntz there. And I'd been a fan of J.A. Jauntz, I guess, since she started writing. I think I had a copy of every book she's ever written for a while. And she encouraged me to look into Sisters in Crime. And I did, and I became a part of it then. And that's been, I don't know, over 20 years ago. And I've been very pleased to be a part of the organization. And when the organization met through email and on this, I wish I could remember the name of the thing where we would actually meet on it, sort of like Messenger, but it wasn't quite as elaborate, you know. And we would meet on there, and I got to visit with some well-known authors and get to know them better and become followers and readers. And I'm not only a writer, I read. And of course, my favorite genre is mystery of some sort. I mean, hey, I was raised on Nancy Drew. What else could you expect?
And so, what are some of your favorite books that you, I know, as we have many, many favorite books, but maybe you could name a few for our listeners.
Oh, I don't know about titles of books because I've read so many, but some of the
Authors.
authors I prefer to write, of course, is J.A. Jauntz, B.J. Daniels, and B.J. Daniels is such a delight. I don't know if you've ever met her or not, but she is just a delightful person. So is J.A. Jauntz. One of my favorite authors of my older years is William Bernhardt. I've known him since he was in high school. I was a speech drama debate teacher, and I got to judge him when he debated in high school. So I've known him. I've known him since he was just a kid. And Bill is one of the, he is so good at helping other writers that he is above and beyond what we consider the mainstream best-selling authors is because he goes beyond being a writer to being an instructor, to being an encourager. But that's also true about another one of my favorite authors, who is Marcia Preston, who is also a member of Tornado Alley. And I met her way back yonder when she had the Byline magazine, and I met her through OWFI. But I've also really been a big fan of hers because her writing, it just resonates with me as a person as well as a reader. And I have so many favorite authors, but those I would have to say are my most favorite authors.
Well, I haven't read all of the people that you mentioned, but and I certainly admire William Bernhardt and the conference he has and the publishing. He helps people get started and get their work out there, and he recognizes good writers and of course Marcia is also one of my favorite writers as well. I love her books. My last question is always, what advice would you have for anyone out there listening who's a beginning or emerging writer?
If you want to be a writer, write. Talking doesn't do the job. People that just talk about writers are not really wanting to be writers, or they would be writing. Keep learning. Hey, I've been writing for many years. I won't, well, let's just say a lot of them. And I'm still learning. I'm still trying. But continue writing even as you learn new things. And even when I was teaching in high school, I attended workshops, I attended clinics, I attended writing classes to keep current. And then I would try things, and if it didn't work for me, I forget it and go on. And that's what anybody needs to do. Don't be afraid to try new the ideas. But if it doesn't work for you as a writer, go ahead. Go back to what is comfortable and works for you. But the idea is to keep writing. And if you're
Yeah.
really a writer, you can't keep from writing.
Just like you did writing an hour a day with your students, and a novel came out of that. That's such a good story. I think that's inspirational, and those are were really good words. Vivian, thank you so much for doing this interview with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And it was nice of your cat to join us. We're on Zoom. I can see her cat. He's beautiful. Or is it a she?
He.
A he. Okay. Well, thank you. Today's interview with Vivian Zabel is being recorded Thursday, February 29th at 2024 on Zoom, and will be edited with the help of the Metropolitan Library System branch in Bethany, Oklahoma. It will be published Friday, March 15th, 2024 on Buzzsprout, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts.